Oh, usually just, hi. Knox, we're trying to make a podcast here.
That's Erin Drayton and my dog Knox, who desperately wanted to be part of this episode. My name's Sean, and you're listening to Something Shifted. Here on Something Shifted, we know that mindset matters, moving from setbacks to thriving comebacks, and we're here for all of it. Of course, the podcast is about that space between your head and your heart as you navigate change and figure out more about yourself through those experiences. Today, we speak with Erin Drayton.
It's actually good to see you, really.
Erin and I first crossed paths in the early 2000s. She was hosting a children's television show called Hip to Be Square. She started off as a mad scientist and progressed to become their anchor presenter and was nominated for a prestigious South African Film and Television Award. Erin is younger than I am, but was always just a few years ahead of me in terms of her career. We both volunteered at MFM 92.6 at Stellenbosch University and both hosted shows on Good Hope FM. She found her way back to radio 10 years after packing up her headphones and currently has a slot on Smile 90.4 FM. Erin has racked up all sorts of achievements outside of radio and television too, like an advanced defensive driving certification, classic and jazz training on the flute, and a BCom marketing degree. Erin and I have shared many media experiences, hers far more decorated than mine, but it's the fact that we both have children with special needs that binds us tightly together.
You usually just text messages on my phone.
Something Shifted continues next. So we're definitely going to speak about how your son's healthcare has changed the way you see the world. But before we get there, can you think of an experience maybe somewhere in your life that has shaped the person you've become, Erin?
I think probably when I was in primary school. I clearly remember this. My parents went to a parent-teacher meeting, and my teacher had noted that I had trouble spelling certain words. And my dad came home and spoke to me about it that night, that how I should focus like a lot more on my spelling. And at the time, I remember thinking like, what am I doing wrong? But at the same time, I was also like, this is a thing you can fix. And very shortly after that, sort of the next thing I remember at school is the absolute thrill of scoring really high on a test or on a project. And that has stayed with me. That stayed with me like all through school. Instead of being really freaked out by it or being afraid, seeing what the result was of putting in the work kind of gave me a kick.
I know you completed a BSc Biological Human Life Sciences at Stellenbosch University, yeah. Which I think communicates to others, this girl is smart, right? And I wonder through it all, if you considered yourself to be smart and how much weight intelligence has had over your life.
Up until a certain point, it held a lot of weight for me. And then I think probably around my early 20s, I just let it go. Famous story. My high school had a growing, but obviously at the time that I was there, small population of learners of color. We're like late 90s heading into the 2000s. And I was the first learner of color to be elected into a leadership position, which was the school's representative council of learners, which was a huge thing at the time. When we found out that in the grade 10 of us were going to apply to study medicine, I was the only one of color. And that sparked a huge conversation about whether or not I would be accepted on merit or whether or not I would be accepted on quota.
Not only did Erin spend her grade 11 year grafting to prove that she had the academic chops to be accepted on merit, but she also pushed herself to participate and achieve in extracurriculars too.
I had the same marks as my peers because I earned them, and I had, you know, all these amazing achievements in debate and choir and all of that jazz to back it up. It was no surprise that out of 10 of us, 5 got accepted and I was one of the 5. I put so much weight on me being as smart as everybody else. I lost a lot of sense of that shouldn't be the only thing that matters. There are other aspects of me that are important as well. And that you can be really smart, but depending on the situation that you're in, your smarts can count for almost nothing as well. And it comes down to logic and tenacity and resilience and determination. And this shift has helped me build a very interesting career path. I've worked in places where I should not be because I'm not formally qualified to do what I do, but I do it because I've been very adaptable. I learn very quickly. I always say my brother is actually smarter than I am. My perception of what matters has changed drastically from my early 20s to now. And of course, marriage and children play a big part in that as well.
So far, we know that Erin is adaptable and very smart. Dealing with the unexpected doesn't seem to bother her.
My dad's parents come from like the Athlone area, grew up quite poor. And my grandmother learns how to drive in her mid-40s. And she would pick us up from school in the afternoon. It only hit me much later, like what an accomplishment that was. But my grandparents, all four of them actually, were very dynamic people, very involved in their community, very, very, very well loved. Their joy and zest for life and their welcoming of people into their homes all the time, and their involvement with other people very much rubbed off on me. We're very social. We're a very social family. And they spearheaded that for us and modeled that for us. Friday nights at my grandparents' house was lit, man. Like there was music going. My grandfather was brying. And we loved being there. And I willingly like chose to stay at my grandparents' house during school holidays up until I was about 12. And when I tell people like, by the way, like my whole family comes from Bontevil, they're like usually very surprised.
I know you believe in therapy, and I've only recently started recommending to soon-to-be parents that they go to therapy before their child arrives, because all of our triggers seem to surface once you add children into the mix. What was your journey to therapy like, through therapy like?
In 2018, I was in a job that I didn't realize was, I can't say stressing me out. It was literally giving me anxiety attacks. And I had had these like weird physical symptoms for about 2 months. My doctor was kind of concerned and we did this blood draw. We found out that my cortisol level was really, really low. And basically things were not great with my adrenal system. And I was immediately booked off work. After discussing like my symptoms versus the blood test, my doctor then quickly realized I'd been having anxiety attacks maybe 2-3 times a day for 8 weeks. So my system was really, 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 really run down. And I said to her, okay, what's the course of treatment? And she said, well, first of all, we need to get your cortisol level, right? So you're going to be booked off work for a week. And then I'm going to put you on like low dose anti-anxiety medication, but I want you to go to therapy. I'm painfully self-aware. So we get through some things quickly. And in my second session, there was a moment where I was explaining to my counselor something that had triggered me at work. And we pulled back the layers, pulled back the layers, pulled back the layers. And finally, she's like, and why did it make you feel that way? And the words that came out of my mouth was, because I feel like I'm not good enough. And I proceeded to sit and cry for 15 minutes after that. And that is how we found out that the root cause of my anxiety is me not feeling good enough.
Erin worked through these feelings with her counselor for a couple of weeks and then went out into the world on her own again. Until not that long ago, actually, when things changed one more time.
About a year and a half ago, oh no, almost 2 years ago, my husband and I were both unemployed for a chunk of lockdown. Very stressful. We were living with my folks because we had to. And getting back on track was, you know, was hard for us, but it also happened quite quickly. It was the beginning of the year and I was basically just frayed. I was internally, I was not good. My husband and I had had a massive fight. And at the time, my thought was, oh my gosh, I'm going to destroy my marriage. And I don't want that to happen. And I went online and I booked the appointment. I've been with my therapist since then, and we've had a very interesting journey. So I would say that it started off with just unraveling and unpacking 2 years worth of unprocessed trauma, plus then realizing there was a lot of stuff associated with my son and him having a disability that I hadn't worked through yet. Then it was recognizing what are my triggers and how better to manage them. So she's equipped me with really great skills and processes so that I can take better care of myself.
And when a milestone celebration rolled around, Erin decided to go even deeper.
I turned 40 and I said to her, I would like to go into this next phase of my life better prepared and in a much better state than my elders ever got the chance to do. Having lived through the loss of my grandparents, 3 of them in 1 year, having lived through the loss of 2 homes, 2 jobs, pandemic, and having to build back up from that again, I can say that is a lot. I have the chance to take that and turn it into good that I carry with me so that when I get to age 60, 70, 80, I can look back and say, I healed, I did better, I lived better. And that is what I wanted for myself. And so therapy has been very instrumental in guiding me to get to this point and also giving me a space to explore past feelings, current feelings, and also learning how to better manage my anxiety.
And Erin wasn't the only one to benefit from her therapy.
I was able to recognize fairly quickly that my daughter has anxiety as well. Same as me. We've got like really mild cases, but it has pretty explosive consequences. And we got her into a play therapy process this year, which was so massively helpful. And to parents out there who have tweens or teens going through puberty, do not underestimate the power of therapy in strengthening your relationship with your child, improving your communication with your child, and giving them a better foundation as they go into their teen and adult years. We as a family can say it's been incredibly helpful for us. We're in a really, really, really good space, and we are great about feelings and talking about stuff. It's brought us much, much closer together. And I am very happy to shout from the rooftops, yo, don't be afraid to go to that therapy. It's good for you. My therapist did say this to me one day, though. She's like, isn't it funny how life gives you kids that you don't know you need? On the one hand, she's like, well, Michael's obviously the bigger one of the bigger issue of the two. She's like, I have a big thing about having a sense of control over stuff. And Michael is the complete antithesis of that. He threw my whole plan for my life, my whole thought of life completely off its axis. And for that, I am actually truly grateful. But he challenges my need for control on a daily basis, which is a really, really good thing. And he very much marches to the beat of his own drum, and he's incredibly stubborn. That's great. I've had to learn to adapt around that. Ren, on the other hand, is far more like creative and dreamy and loving than I am. And she got her dad's sense of humor. So I don't often understand like what's funny to her, but we have a really close connection because I've also learned as a parent to be a calm and a safe space for her in her moments. And she's appreciative of the fact that when I could see that she needed help, I advocated very strongly for that and supported her through that journey. So, yeah, that's what therapy means for us. And I'm very happy to talk about it. I'm pretty open about it. And I will say my therapist is also really cool. One of my last sessions I had with her, she wore a hoodie that said on the front, I came, I saw I had anxiety, so I left. I laughed a lot in that session. It was really hysterical.
Please, will you tell me about Michael? How do you treat him? How do you respond to people that see him for the first time? What's it like being Michael's mom?
I think for the most part, I don't think about the fact that he has Down syndrome a lot because he's just my child. He's there. And we are obviously very used to the uniqueness of him that comes with that. For me, it's when we go out in public, especially in places where we maybe haven't been before, that I'm always a bit on my guard. I'm obviously concerned for his physical safety, number one. He doesn't move like other children because of his low muscle tone, his hypermobility. He doesn't, you know, walk like other kids. He doesn't have the same physical strength as other kids. And he struggles to see as well. So he wants to check things out. And then it's also the fact that I can see immediately when people look at him and they clock like, okay, like this child is different or this child has Down syndrome. And then it becomes that split second of waiting to see what is their response going to be. What I've always done is I approach that with a lot of like kindness. I smile first just so that they know we're not like weird and sensitive. You can greet him. And he now is very sociable. So he walks in public and he greets people who walk past him. And what's been a challenge recently is whether or not people greet him back. People maybe, let's say, age 45 and older, greet back immediately. No reservation. You know, we'll say, hi, how are you? Like, oh, you're so cute today, da 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 da. Younger people, very, very hesitant. They're not quite sure how to approach it. And my daughter, you know, models and does TV commercial acting. So we go to a lot of castings and we always encounter young people in casting studios. Sometimes Michael comes with. And it's always interesting when these young models come in and he's standing there and he goes, hello, hello, hello. And they don't know. They freeze. They're like deer in the headlights. And then I'm like, it's okay. He's just saying hello. Please greet him back. They say hello back and he goes, how are you? And then suddenly they're like, oh, I'm fine. How are you? And the ice like immediately melts. It's an interesting way to move through the world when you've got something that's different.
I can see so many similarities to what Erin is explaining and how I feel when I take my child out in public. But in her case, there is just one extra layer.
My husband is 11 years older than me. He's white. I'm beautifully melanated. When we go out as a family, we look different and we're cool with that. Stare at us and recognize that this is what a modern family looks like. We're different in age, different in race, and we've got a kid with a disability. But also with Michael, I sort of vacillate between being a very protective mom and also being a mom who pushes him to do stuff. I've very much from, you know, young, past his first heart surgery, have been like, right, we're going to therapy. I'm going to get you the help and the support that you need. I'm very involved in his therapeutic process, doing a lot of my own work and research at the same time. I worked really hard to get him into school, and I'm very communicative with his teachers there because I want to be involved and be part of the process. So that's me being like the mom who's like, you got to do stuff, kiddo. You're going to go places, and I'm going to push your boundaries just a little bit because it's good for you. And he's like, I say, he's quite headstrong and independent. We got to build on that by making him do stuff that draws on that confidence. And then my protective mom vibes come out when I can feel like, okay, the situation's becoming a little too intense for him, whether that's sensorily. He comes to family dinners and he's learned already that when he's done, he gets up quietly from his seat. He comes to either his dad or I, and he very quietly says to you, go home. And it's like, okay, you're done now. He's very polite about the whole thing. He does it every year at Christmas Eve dinner. When he's had enough of like the loud family gathering, he quietly comes to us, go home. Like, okay, thank you, boy. He's very cute like that. And also when I see like other kids that maybe are physically like too much for him, too big for him, I will step in and very like gently remove him from the situation. But I think more than that, he's been a huge, huge learning experience for me. And it's also because I'm getting to know him and realizing that he and I are actually more alike than I sometimes would care to admit. We are actually very alike in personality. And because he's been with me for so long, he was at home with me for basically 6 years while I was working. It was actually strange to let him go off to school the first few days because I was so used to him physically being with me all the time. But it was also me recognizing it's good, like you have to go off and be in the world and in your own space and make your own experiences. But that's who he is. He's our guy. He's our little bride master. Yeah.
A 10-year journey. And it, I mean, when you speak about it now, it's very jovial. It's very light. It's very, in hindsight, things have worked out really well. At the time, I remember those heart surgeries. I remember I wasn't there. I wasn't in those rooms. I wasn't part of those conversations, but I could feel the incredible amount of tension, anxiety that one carries because you just don't have the answers. And I remember sitting in NICU. It was neonatal ICU with Zoe the first time I got to hold her because she was also under machines and wires and help her breathe and all sorts of things. And I remember distinctly saying to her, I might not be able to give you everything you want, but you'll always have everything that you need. Mm. I didn't know at the time how little she would want. She doesn't want for much.
Yeah.
And how much I would need to give for her. Like, it's my deep-seated need to give her as much as I possibly can, the input, the experiences, the exposure, the support, the awareness that other people need to have around who she is and what she's capable of doing. And I hear that through what you're saying as well. It's a very enlightening journey. I don't like to hear people tell me that I'm an inspiration or that God has given me a child that only I could handle. I don't like hearing that stuff, but I do like people acknowledging how much she has developed, how much progress she has made. That's very special for me.
If I can touch on that point specifically, I reject that same notion as you. And I think we maybe have the same reason why. And it's because, back to that whole thing, in therapy, when I had that revelation that I'm not good enough, that has played out very much in parenting Michael. Because when you get told your child has this disability, the first thing that happened in my mind was, me, I'm to blame for this. I wasn't good enough. And I mean, it's it's really daft when you think about it. I wasn't good enough to, you know, have the one egg that didn't have the extra chromosome. That is bonkers. Like, why would it? Literally, one of my friends who's a geneticist had to text me to remind me, you understand the science of this. It's random. And then when you think about the randomness, you're like, but why me? Like, am I not good enough to just have the normal, straightforward, white picket fence suburban life? You know? And once you get past it, it's like, oh my gosh, now I'm not good enough to raise this child. I'm not good enough to give this child every single 4,000 rand device that they need or therapy that they need 3 times a week for the rest of their lives. Yeah, yeah, hey, you're going to tire yourself out if you go at it from that perspective. And getting past thinking that I wasn't good enough to be his parent came about actually through being his parent, was going through the motions and the processes with him and eventually looking and actually taking moments to look back and say, you know what, we got through this and that was the success. And because I think Michael's story on its own was written entirely by him. From, you know, how I found out I was pregnant. I was not meant to be pregnant at the time. He was a very happy planned accident, I will say, to the fact that he arrived a month early, very much on his own accord. Like, he came out, I'm done, yo. I'm getting into the world. And even, you know, he was just like, I'm good now at 36 weeks. I'm going to go. But even, you know, where the doctors were saying, like, wow, for a premature baby, he was really, really strong and vital and finding out that he had a heart defect, but he was growing and thriving. He has literally given us this adventure very much on his own. And so I was looking at him because he did not do well after his first surgery. And we were very concerned for 5 days about whether or not he would actually survive because he was not breathing on his own. He was on a ventilator with severe pneumonia. And I went into the ICU one day and there'd been no change. And the doctors were starting to worry now. And I was watching him, he was sedated, and I whispered in his ear, I'm like, listen to me now, little dude. I'm like, you have a choice here. You've decided all of this, you need to now make a choice. I'm like, if you feel you need to let go, then let go, I'll be okay. But if you feel you're gonna stay here, then I need you to please, like, fight, and I'll fight with you, I'll fight for you. But can you just make a choice? Like, you've kept us here for 5 days. Can you like choose? He literally did the next day and got himself out of pediatric ICU. He'd been there for 14 days, yeah, and got himself out within the next 3 days. And he has been very headstrong ever since.
Michael turned a corner after that pep talk from his mum, but he still needed to do a lot of work before being discharged from the hospital.
They tried to get him off the ventilator. His organs started failing and they put him back on the ventilator. Had the doctors come in to do a scan and they discovered that there was fluid in the lining of his lungs, which they had missed. And all it was a simple change of medication and he started getting better. He had to bottle feed to graduate out of surgical ICU to go back into the pediatric ward. And he drank 10 mils to graduate out. And then the doctors were like, okay, cool. He needs, because, you know, babies have had surgery, they're all bottle fed. And we tried to feed him for a day and a half. And a nurse said, she's like, he seems like a very stubborn boy. I'm like, he is. And she's like, well, did you breastfeed him before all of this? I was like, yes, I did. She's like, well, I know we're not supposed to, but why don't we just give him a chance and see if he's going to try? I'm like, woman, he's 11 weeks old. He's pup from pneumonia. He's on so much antibiotics. He's got an NG tube down his throat. There's no way in hell he's going to feed. My word. We let him try and he fed. So he's a character like that. Like, there's nothing I did in all of this. This is very much him. I am literally the custodian of this child who is a force on his own. And it is my great honor and privilege to be that for him. And he's given me experiences that have truly pushed me to be a better version of myself. Like, he's shown me the enormous gratitude for small things, for small progress, for small achievements. He's also changed my perspective on what does it mean to be good enough. In many senses, people can look at him and say, he's not good enough for this. But what about the stuff he is good enough for? And that is the key. That is the thing you focus on. Not what he can't do. What can he do and build from that? And if that isn't a lesson for all of us, then I absolutely don't know what is.
Which of your achievements are you most proud of?
becoming really okay with who I am. I can sit here now, Sean, and say to you, like, I'm a 40-year-old woman who's never had a bond, doesn't own her own home, I'm not in the career I thought I was gonna be in, and I have two kids and one of them has a disability. You look at that on paper, it doesn't sound like the definition of success, and I think one of my biggest achievements has been redefining what the hell success is for myself. It has been a very long, very painful, very slow journey to get to that, considering I am someone who is used to academic achievement, work achievement, defining who I am as a person. Having to redefine all of that is an achievement in and of itself. And I can now look at my life and say, I have a relationship, a marriage, but also just a relationship. I've been with my husband for 20 odd years. He was my first serious boyfriend and I kept him. But we have been through a lot of ups and downs together. Our marriage has been seriously tested and we've come back from each of those times stronger than we were before. And he's still my best friend. That is success. I have two children who I'm not even saying this in a hyperbolic fashion. They're forces of nature. I'm extremely proud of each of them, not for their achievements, but for who they are as people. That is success. I've created a really interesting career for myself. I'm able to work remotely and be there to pick up my children from school and to take them to gymnastics and all sorts of things. That is success, being able to work and be a parent at the same time. I make really great cheesecake. That is a success. I've never flopped a recipe that I've tried to bake. I have incredible parents who have been really supportive. And can I just say, at my 40th birthday, I did ad lib cards where you had to fill in random things. And they some of them were really, really funny. And my parents had to fill them in. And I read my dad's card. And one of the things he said in there was, you're too hard on yourself. Me, very taken aback that my father actually said that. Because I had grown up with this thing in my mind, thinking my parents expected so much of me. And to have my father say at 40, you're too hard on yourself, it was like the apology you didn't know you needed, or like the validation you didn't know you wanted. And that was very, very meaningful. And to have my parents who are able to provide that support, that is success. I have great friends. I have people like you in my life who I can text randomly at night and say, I need a swimming school. Got any recommendations? And you answer back. And I also just think that as someone who could get very caught up in just parenting alone, I'm extremely privileged that I get to be in radio still and to take what is my passion. And it's gone beyond a hobby now. I can't actually explain what it is because, yeah, it's work, but it never feels like work. And I get to speak to people and hear their stories and hear their songs and support their careers. It's very meaningful to me. It's for me, like, my radio show is not just a space where I get to do something that's just for me and it's not even a selfish thing. It's a very much an extension of my personality. But that I get to be part of other people's lives in doing that and it makes a difference, that is success. And so I read a quote a couple of weeks ago that said, if you make something you like and you share it with the world because you like it, that is success. Is that not a great North Star for each of us in our lives?
If you make something you like and you share it with the world because you like it, that is success. I think I might steal that one. Thank you for listening to this episode of Something Shifted. My life has changed quite a lot over the years, and having a child with developmental delays and epilepsy has really shifted my perspective. You can find plenty more episodes of this podcast on your favorite player and review the show right now to help it grow. Subscribe and never miss another story of hope and resilience. And you can also find us online at somethingshifted.co.za. I make podcasts for businesses and individuals. And if you have a story about how your life has changed financially, mentally, physically, emotionally, please do let me know. You can reach me by sending an email to hello@somethingshifted.co.za or find me on the socials at Sean Lewitz. Until the next time, keep shifting.